This prism may tell a story using different dimensions. It turns out that when it comes to rock art, the pictographs may not just tell one story, but many. A new investigation into 6,000-year-old rock art discovered in as many as 50 separate caves demonstrates what the people of the Cumberland Plateau in the Appalachian Mountains thought of, not just in terms of their daily lives and duties, but how they constructed their ideas of the cosmos. Looking through the prism to help us decode patterns in prehistoric art, we are joined by Jan Simek. He's a president emeritus and distinguished professor of science with the Department of Anthropology at the University of Tennessee. Welcome, Dr. Simek.
Thank you for having me.
Recently, a number of new finds have been made, and by piecing together these artifacts, I understand you've been able to make a new discovery about the whole. What have you found?
Let me start by saying that these discoveries are more recent than one might think, but they're not really, at least in their totality, very recent. We've been working on this material for almost two decades now. It takes that long to go out into the rougher areas of Tennessee, North Alabama, North Georgia, and find these prehistoric rock art sites that are, for the most part, produced in very, very difficult areas to get to. Some of the art sites we're looking at are actually deep inside of caves, and that requires exploration of the cave, obviously the recognition and identification of the rock art inside. So it is something we've been at for a long time. But despite the fact that we've been at it for a long time, we've talked a lot about, at least in the archaeological fraternity, about individual sites and about some of the depictions that we see in there. It's really only recently we've had enough sites to be able to look at patterns on the landscape. And so to answer the second part of your question, what we've really recently come to realize is that taken all together, the 50 open-air rock art sites and just about 50 cave art sites that we've managed to accumulate through our work over the last couple of decades seem to have a relationship in space. They are part of a bigger composition, if you will, that has a landscape dimension.
And what does that actually mean? Does that mean that if I took a pictograph or a sample of art from one place and linked it with something 5 or 20 or 30 miles further, they would continue the story?
Essentially, yes. But maybe more appropriately, the story itself, a story that comes almost certainly from the religious, the mythological, the cosmological belief systems of these prehistoric people, that cosmology has been imposed through this artwork on the landscape. There is a structure to it that is determined by what people believe. And essentially what they're doing, we believe, is taking the natural world and onto it they are sketching, they're drawing their spiritual world. So that, yes, on one level, you might see similar themes and similar contexts in different sites that are several miles apart. But maybe more importantly, the whole, in order to appreciate the spiritual model that is being presented, you need to understand the overall structure of all of these sites. And we're talking about a very big area, in fact. We believe that this cosmogram, this picture of the spiritual world, extends all the way from a little bit south of the Kentucky border in Tennessee all the way down into North Alabama. So 100 miles, more like, than 35.
So there are definitely different pictures at different levels.
There are elements of certain themes in both places, but they're expressed differently. So, for example, what we call anthropomorphs, human images are common both in the high area and down deep inside of caves. But when humans are depicted inside of caves, they're often transforming into something else, into bird creatures, into weapons. There's a transformational character to them that doesn't occur on the upper bluffs. Birds are very common inside of caves. They never occur in the high bluff paintings. Serpents occur only in caves. They don't occur on the high bluff paintings. The high bluff paintings are humans, but involved in what appears to be sort of more mundane aspects or aspects of life, or very often the human characters outside of caves are illustrated in a position with their arms up and their hands extended and their digits highly exaggerated, a posture that we know reflects shamans and their behavior as they try to engage with the spiritual world on behalf of people. And one of the most important differences is actually color. Prehistoric paintings that are outside of caves, that are up high on the bluffs, are with very few exceptions, painted in red pigments. Prehistoric paintings deep inside of caves in the lower part of the plateau topography are almost always painted in black, with, again, a very few exceptions. And we know from ethnographic study that red for Native Americans in the Southeast was the color of life, the color of the dawn. It was a very positive sort of sense. Black, as in many cultures, was the color of death, the color of the underworld, and has a negative connotation.
Well, but could that latter simply be a matter of pragmatism? Maybe when you were higher up, there would be more clays, so there would be more red rocks. And when you were down below, there might be more coal, more charcoal, more substances which would lend itself to black coloration.
Well, on the one hand, that's probably not true. The charcoal, the charcoal they would have had to bring with them anyway. We've done chemical analyses of these paints, and actually quite a bit of chemical analyses of these paints. And one of the striking things about them is that the recipes they use to produce them are very consistent. They take a very fine-grained clay, probably white, and there are a number of clays, muscovite, illite, kaolinite, that might serve. That occur in these areas. They mix it with water. They actually create a slurry, and then they introduce a coloring agent, what we call a chromophore. And if they want black paint, that chromophore is charcoal. If they want red paint, that chromophore orange, which sometimes occurs. So in any case, in either of those cases, the paint is probably produced somewhere else.
Which certainly adds to your speculation that this was a cosmological or spiritual thing, that there was a lot of preparation and a lot of forethought into the production of.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And we know that in the cases of caves, that such forethought was already part of the equation, because one of the main reasons that this work, the recent publication on this work anyway, has received such great attention is that the fact that really for the first time we are talking about a coherent tradition of prehistoric artwork in North America that includes true cave art. So some of the sites that we've worked on contain prehistoric art over a mile underground. So the fact that they're penetrating that deep into the underworld is really compelling. They have to provision themselves. They have to plan it. It is an enterprise to do that. It's a logistical problem, and it has to be thought through. It's not just paint that becomes the issue at that point. It's light. It's warmth. It's the ability to get in and get out. Some of these caves are so deep and dark that it's quite a dangerous undertaking to go in there. And so they're confronting the darkness on a whole variety of levels when they go underground to paint. But yeah, planning and foresight are critical elements in this whole process.
And I've only caved once in my life, but I do remember when slithering through that hole and working through the cave with relatively modern equipment, it was very slick, very uneven surfaces, very strange footing. So to go down there and a mile in the kind of caves I'm imagining, that puts you at jeopardy. That's a fairly serious enterprise, isn't it?
Absolutely. And to give you a sort of an example, there's a cave in northern Tennessee that actually is much earlier than much of what we're talking about, this cosmogram that we're talking about. But in this cave, they went over a mile underground and incised drawings on the ceiling. So they weren't using paint. They were making engravings. But at the same time, they were mining chert out of the deposits in the floor of this cave a mile underground. So they were actually going down there to work. As they moved into the cave, they used river cane torches, which are wonderful light sources to move through cave passageways. The trouble with river cane is when you reach the underground, when you're in a deep area that you want to stop and occupy yourself, they smoke like crazy. It is not a good light source when you're not moving. And they had actually thought about this and solved this problem. They had brought small pieces of heart of pine that had been dried. They could make small fires, local fires, in order to work by that wouldn't smoke. So they had anticipated and countered the logistic problems that they were facing in working in this underground environment. And yes, the pathways in were very dangerous. There's one place going again into this particular location where they had to chimney across a 60-foot deep chasm by putting their feet against one wall and their back against the other and moving about 60 feet along the edges of the walls. And as they did that, they were barefoot. We know that because we see their footprints on the other side when they reached the pathway on the other side. So they had a very strong sense of need of requirement that guided their activities underground. It was dangerous enough that I don't believe it was likely for them to do it unless they really felt like they had to.
And let's talk about your need to do this, because obviously you're following these people down, and it's sort of the reverse of the old why do you climb the mountain question. How did you go into these caves? What did you bring with you? And how did you examine them? More importantly, or equally importantly, when you went into these caves or looked up above, how whole, how intact was the cave art?
That's a very good question, because, and I think the answer is that it depends. It's variable. Well, because in some cases, when we're deep underground, I suspect that in some of these caves, we're looking pretty much at the complete complement of cave art. They did it in an area that has not seen much visitation since the art was produced. It was done in a medium and in a way that has great durability. There's not been geological processes that alter it. And so what we're looking at is a pretty good sense of what was there. I think in particular of the cave in Middle Tennessee that contains over 400 tiny, very fine engravings on the limestone walls, all the way down to under a centimeter in size. The only way you can see it is with very indirect raking light across it. If you didn't know that these were there, you would never see them, and yet they're preserved in that location. There are other sites, though, where the artwork is closer to the mouth of the cave. There's been visitation since that time. There's been graffiti in many cases laid over the top of it. There have been geological processes that have brought about the destruction of some of it. There's a particular form of artwork we find in Tennessee caves called mud glyphs, where they're literally engraving or even in some senses finger painting images into plastic clay surfaces that adhere to the clay wall, to the cave walls and ceilings. There's an internal environment that kind of preserves that clay that may or may not continue with climate change, with alteration, modern alterations of the landscape. And so in many cases, I suspect art has been obliterated by time and or by the activities of subsequent human occupations.
Now, one thing I believe is that if you expose certain artwork to light, especially in an area which is not used to light, that light itself can be destructive. So how did you study these paintings?
That's probably not so much a problem underground, because they haven't been exposed to very much light. And so when there are pictographs in caves, they tend to be pretty fresh, unless they've seen subsequent alteration by graffiti. The one place where the public at least used to be able to go and see this artwork, this prehistoric artwork, is a Tennessee State Natural Area called Dunbar Cave, which is a little bit north of Nashville in Clarksville, Tennessee. The paintings there had been there for obviously hundreds, thousands, maybe 1,000 years in a cave that had been shown for the last 100 years as a show cave, had had tourists taken through it. And the state of Tennessee still takes people through it as part of their tours. The artwork was behind panels that had been heavily altered by graffiti, some of it dating to the Civil War. But it had done enough damage to the artwork behind that until we went there, and we used red light sources to see black pigment, for example, to try to tease out some of the pictures, we began to see things that people had missed for all that time.
Taking a look at a puzzle and discovering the cosmos. I'm Andrew Hiller for The Prism, and I've been joined by Jan Simek. He's the President Emeritus and Distinguished Professor of Science in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Tennessee. Thank you so much for taking us on this tour.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Before we leave, a moment in The Prism. The world today is composed of an astounding number of wonders. Moving staircases, computers that fit in my pocket, house paint that acts as a solar collector. Flash Gordon and Captain Kirk would be envious of the technology we have today. I mean, please, compare Kirk's communicator to your cell phone. Our good Starfleet captain would goggle at the idea of Skype. Flash Gordon's rocket ships? They needed guide wires. We have followed the musings of H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, and Michael Crichton into a world of scientific wonder, full of submarines, cloning, and genetic wonders. Think about how much the world has changed just in your lifetime. We live in a world of science fiction. Of course, it comes with a dark side. Every advance has its shadow, and every leap of progress comes with a warning of dystopia. How would George Orwell sit in a world with the Patriot Act, or Google copying every bit of our private information? Would the idea of GPS tracking blow his paranoid mind? More. The labor force is undergoing a seismic change that we have not fully understood yet. With computerization, automation, and robotics, the next shift will not be to a new technology or field, but a change in the understanding of value and place. How many of us will become the obsolete John Henry, unable to compete? Will our voracious imagination be tempered by reason and morality? If not, we Eloi will certainly be devoured by H.G. Wells' Morlocks. Still, this foreboding has to be balanced by the age of wonders we live in. We are slowly getting a handle on cancer, Alzheimer's, and even the common cold. We are giving people with paralysis the ability to walk again. And through our astronomers' eyes, our instruments have seen deep into the very beginnings of the universe. Every day, the human mind is reaching out to find new dreams. And every day, so many of those marvels are coming within reach. Not all of those miracles are big. Some are small, and no less precious for that. And who knows, which ripple, which crushed butterfly will change the world? So, I leave the prism today with this thought. Will you create a wonder today? For the Voice of Russia and the Prism, I'm Andrew Hiller. Thank you for examining the world through the prism. This show could not have been made without the help of many. Thanks to our guests, our engineers, Warren Reed, Ryan Troublefield, Andrei Lupachov, Anthony Robinson, and Ford Cruz, without whose help and expertise, the prism would certainly sound and look differently. Thanks also to Alicia Hiller-Mamadov and Carmen Russell-Sluchansky for their ideas and help on the web. And if you want to hear one of the stories you've missed, take a second spin through the prism, leave a comment, or suggest a story, you can find archives on the Voice of Russia website. Thank you so much for listening to The Prism, and for The Voice of Russia, I'm Andrew Hiller.